Silence.
Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerf Ray Radio.
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 28 of Nerd Pride Radio. 28, it's 7 times 4. It is a horribly unattractive composite number. I am so sorry about that. Yet, 28 is the traditional curing time in days of concrete, and this is really cool. 28 is the common name for a species of Australian ringneck parrot. Apparently, this bird, extremely versatile, extremely hardy, reminds me a lot of a Quaker parakeet that I used to own, except it's got a black head on it. This bird is named 28 because it has a very distinctive call that sounds for all the world like 28, much like the whippoorwill in North America. So that was cool, right? So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's probably 7 other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is the place where I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff I just can't fit in my brain anymore. Sadly, due to recent controversy in which I inadvisedly referred to Will Wheaton as a whore and a prostitute, we've had to say goodbye to a number of our sponsors, including the recently added Aperture Science Technologies, but I want to assure you that this is only a temporary setback. We are replacing these turncoats with even bigger and better sponsors as we speak. So, on that note, I would like to welcome our newest and probably biggest sponsor we've ever had, Black Mesa. Welcome to our Nerd Pride family. It is good to have you on board. We appreciate your support. Before we start the show, it's time for excuses, excuses, excuses. That's right. My schedule has been way off for the last month or so. I didn't even think I'd be getting a podcast out this week. Just things have been off, and I apologize. I am going to get back on track. But now for the excuses, I promised. Look, my oldest son, Gygax, went to state speech, and so we've had a big time preparing for that. My mom came down to visit. While my mom was here, she's still here, in fact, she wound up getting appendicitis, so we wound up missing state speech entirely, me and her, because we were up at the hospital. She had emergency surgery. She's fine now. Everything's doing very well. She's recovering great. But it's just been busy. My air conditioning went out, and we had to wait around for repair guys earlier this week. I had a problem with the plumbing, had just all sorts of stuff. But all of it is shaping up. It is a beautiful day. I get to record, and it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me. This is a good day. So with that out of the way, it is time for yet another installment of our all-too-frequent segment, Mike Was Wrong! Yeah, it turns out, I mentioned in the last episode, I talked about binary numbers, hexadecimal, base 8, base 4. I had a bunch of fun talking about numbers, because that's the kind of guy I am. And I referred to, probably on more than one occasion, I referred to base 8 as octadecimal, which I'm surprised none of you called me on it. What kind of nerds are you? Turns out octadecimal would probably, I think, be base 18, because, you know, octa 8, decimal 10. Turns out base 8 is actually just called octal. I should have known that. But see, I only found this out because after the whole discussion last time, I went out and started doing some more research on different numbering systems, and all the research I did said if we're going to do something other than base 10, honestly, base 8, octal, would really be the way to go. Only because hexadecimal people are just annoying. They've come up with all new pronunciations for stuff. You can't just say, you know, if you have a 1 followed by a 5, you can't just say 15. There's like a whole separate word now for the teens and for millions and for It's terrible. Base 8, you can just call numbers as numbers, and you don't have to memorize the names of new digits. Nothing. It's so nice. So, anyway, I was wrong. I apologize. We've said it right. Let's get into the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week, or in this case, couple of weeks. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy week, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record, you lucky dogs. And, as it turns out, most of the topics that are on the master list this week have been there for a couple weeks. I've had everything planned and plotted for ages, and then we got busy and I forgot about it. So some of this, I'm going to be really pulling at the memory to figure out what the hell I wanted to talk about. Bear with me. It's going to be a fun ride. First up on the master list, we're going to head on over to the science corner.
She blinded me with science.
That's right. If you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. I have just recently had a run-in, yet again, with the changing sizes of packaging for foods. This is not uncommon, but here's the deal. There's actually been at least it sounds scientific when you read the title. If you have never read anything by Stephen Jay Gould, in my opinion, Stephen Jay Gould is a pretentious, pompous sort of ass, or at least he was when he was alive. He died 10 years ago. But Stephen Jay Gould's writing is fascinating, all right? And yeah, he can get opinionated and he can get snotty about stuff, but he writes really good, fascinating scientific stuff, and it's awesome. And specifically, from his book Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes, he wrote an article in that book entitled Phyletic Size Decrease in Hershey Bars, where he did a full study of size versus cost in Hershey bars over five decades, and it's just fascinating. Just fascinating. Starts off with the nickel, I assume, candy bars. I don't have the article in front of me. I'm just working from 10-year-old memories here. But starts off with the nickel candy bar, big old nickel Hershey candy bar back in 1939 or whatever it was. And then he plots on a graph how the Hershey bar decreases in size over the years until finally, you know, you start off with, and who knows how big the original bar was, you know, a 5-ounce bar, a 4-ounce bar, whatever it is. And then slowly they start decreasing the size based on the cost of their ingredients so that you're still paying a nickel for, you know, a candy bar that is essentially half the size of the original. And then suddenly they hit whatever their size price break is, and then boom, they come out with their new improved increased jumbo size mega bar, whatever it's going to be called. Every time they have a new name for their new improved, extra, you know, 20% extra, whatever it is. And they come out with the bigger Hershey bar, the jumbo size bar, but now they've bumped the price up to 10 cents. And a lot of times they'll keep around the old bar for a little bit, and then they phase it out. All right, and so now the new jumbo size bar becomes their standard at 10 cents, and then you watch on the graph as it slowly decreases in size again, until finally they hit that break where, okay, we can't shrink it anymore and still sell it as a reasonable snack to people, so let's bump it up to 15, and boom, look, new jumbo size bar. So every, you know, 4 or 5 years, they come out with their new king size or jumbo size or whatever it's going to be. And this continues, you know, all the way up through, I think his article was written, you know, 1980, early 80s, so, you know, his last data is probably from 79 or something like that. And it's just fascinating to watch this repeated trend through the years. And when I first read this article, I read it maybe 10 years ago, I was fascinated by the concept because I had already seen the thing myself in, of all things, chips and dip. I have a real weakness for cheese. You guys know that, all right? And if I'm going to sit down and have, you know, I've decided I don't care about my health, I don't care about my diet, I just want a horribly unhealthy yet tasty snack, I'm going to sit down and have some kind of chips, and it can be potato chips, corn chips, but it depends. Any kind of chips with some cheese dip. And the absolute best, and I discovered this in college, the absolute best is you go and buy a can of the Frito-Lay jalapeno cheddar dip, all right? An 8-ounce can of jalapeno cheddar dip. And then, if they still had it around here, I would get it. But there's some substitutes. Then you get the 8-ounce bag of Tato Skins cheddar-flavored potato chips. And they are awesome. And they go perfectly together. It still is almost my favorite snack of all time. I could eat this stuff by the ton. And here was the best part, is you buy an 8-ounce bag of potato skins and an 8-ounce can of cheese dip, and they match perfectly. When I get done, I am eating my last chip with my last bit of dip. They line up perfectly, all right? And then one day I go out and I buy my unhealthy snack, and I come home with it, and I get done, and I'm like, well, I have a lot of extra cheese in here. Why is there so much cheese? Because I didn't think I did anything differently, but I must have been skimping because now my chips are gone and there's no cheese left. This is horrifying. And so I look at my bag and I realize that, oh, well, there's only 7.5 ounces of chips in this bag. Are you serious? It's the same bag, same size bag even. It looks exactly the same on the shelf. It cost exactly the same as I've always paid for it. And yet they've given me a half ounce less of potato chips. I was just crushed. And so I started paying attention. And then, of course, I ran into Stephen Jay Gould's article, who described exactly what I was experiencing, and I realized that this is what they're doing to me. And sure enough, I watched my potato skins go from 8 ounces for the perfect bag down to 7.5, 7, 6.5, and apparently a 6.5 ounce bag is the break point for potato skins. Now, lucky for me, the cheese dip never changes. Oh, God, if they were both fluctuating and I had to compensate for that, I don't know what I would do, because that's way too much math in my head. But the 8-ounce can is always an 8-ounce can. You can't really do much to modify it. It's always going to be 8 ounces worth of cheese. But then they hit that point break, and I'm sitting there with 6.5 ounces of chips, and it's just horrible. I had to switch to Pringles, because the Pringles can was actually running at like 7.5 ounces at the time. Balanced out perfectly. But then Tato Skins went and bumped up to their new bonus size bag, and oh, they were up to 9. Oh, that was gorgeous. You know, because seriously, when you get done with chips and dip, you got some extra chips. Who cares? You can always eat extra chips. You don't care about that. But, I mean, what am I going to do? Sit there and spoon out extra cheese dip with my finger because I'm out of chip? Well, yes, that is exactly what I would do and have done. But that's really, really tacky and tasteless. But so good. But okay, so now I have my new bonus bag of 9 ounces of chips. Everything works great, and then slowly they shrink, and I've gone through the cycle like 2 or 3 times. Now, sadly for me, I don't get Tato Skins in this area anymore. The stores that I frequent just don't seem to have them. Every now and then I'll find them somewhere, and I always, if I see them, I wind up buying them just because, well, I may not be in the mood for cheese dip right now, but when I am, oh, these are the best. But then there's also, you guys don't really care, but I'm going to talk anyway. Ruffles comes out with some flavors. I think one of their recent baked potato flavors or something like this, their loaded baked potato, comes out. And other brands will have chips that will taste just like, they'll have that thick, crunchy consistency and the right flavoring to go with it. And it kind of brings back that same experience. Frito-Lay jalapeno and cheddar, along with a big bag of Tato Skins cheddar flavor, cheddar and bacon flavor. That was the best one. That is the perfect snack. So pay attention, because I don't care if it's candy bars or potato chips. Those are really easy ones to follow. I mean, pay close attention. You'll watch them shrink over time, and then suddenly, when the new bonus bag comes out, yeah, watch for your price hike. There it goes. Pringles will do this. They shrink and grow their cans. Their cans get shorter and taller. Based on, you know, where they are in that cycle. Yancey, as I was explaining my pet peeve about all this chips and dip stuff to him, he said, oh, watch the peanut butter. He said, peanut butter is where they get you. You wind up getting the exact same size of peanut butter, exact same size jar, and yet there's like 3 ounces less peanut butter in there. How is that possible? And he says, well, turn it over and look at the bottom. They've suddenly created this concave bottom to it. So instead of having a flat bottom to your jar, the thing curves up and it has this little hemispherical bubble underneath it that pushes out that much extra peanut butter. And yet, it's the same size jar. And things will slowly decrease more and more and more, and yet packaging still looks the same. And you get less and less peanut butter until, oh yeah, you know what? It's time to push it back up to their mega size or whatever they're going to do. Just bizarre to me. And the worst part about them is, it's a trick. And it's always a trick. It's just, it's deceptive packaging, deceptive advertising, in order to get you to pay the same amount that you've always paid for less product, because they're just counting on you to not notice that there's less product. And so therefore, those of us who notice it, even if it's unconsciously, but most of us are smart enough that we actually notice it right away, it's just annoying. It's just an annoying trick. And I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to keep paying for it. they're just going to keep making the packaging and putting out the ads that, you know, announce their new improvements and all that, because they want you to keep buying. And I get that. But, oh, gets under your skin, doesn't it? Especially when you run out of chips and you still have dip left. And that brings me to my latest nerd culture report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, Gonzo, but you are very, very close. This week on the Nerd Culture Report, I have got to... All right, once again, I need business cards. That's what this all amounts to. I ran into someone who, again, was the perfect candidate for listening to this podcast, and I really just needed a business card. I needed to be able to go, hey, you know what? If you like that, seriously, you should tune in. You should listen a little bit. I think you would find this fascinating, and just hand over the card. But I didn't have it, and it's just so awkward to approach it in public. But I am at a career night with my oldest son, Gygax, and at career night, it's at his high school, and they've brought back a bunch of alumni who are now working in various fields, along with some specialists and experts from different fields. But a lot of the panels are made up of alumni, so it's people who they might know or people who are from the area, people who can give them some firsthand experience of how they moved from this particular school into the colleges that they wanted and into the careers that they wanted, how they found their way and offered advice to kids on career night here. It's actually not a bad idea, and there was some interesting stuff there. But as we're waiting around for it to start, we're waiting for the keynote speaker to pitch in. There is one gal sitting just a couple rows in front of us in the bleachers here, and I figured out after a little bit that, oh, she's one of the alumni who's come back. So I'm guessing she's mid-20s. I don't know. And she's kind of quiet, keeping to herself, and she's got her little notebook out. She's kind of taking notes on everything around her, and you can see that she's also kind of scribbling down some ideas for herself because she clearly hasn't prepared to be part of the panel. So she's coming up with some ideas just in case she needs to, you know, speechify coming up. And me and my son and one of his friends are sitting together, and the two of them, the two boys, are kind of picking on each other, and one of them turns to the other and says, yeah, way to go, Edison. And the other guy goes, Edison? He goes, well, yeah, that's what Einstein calls people he thinks are stupid, and which to me is a funny joke. And then from that, they went into, okay, well, then what does Edison call people? Well, he'd call you Tesla. And then we had a whole argument over the appropriateness of Edison and Tesla, and was Tesla really an idiot? Because, you know, I think Edison was really just jealous of him, right? And as we're having this conversation, here's this girl, a woman, sitting a couple rows in front of us, and she turns around and she just says, I am so sorry, but I'm eavesdropping and I can't help but break in. You said Tesla? And yeah. And she said, are you talking about the band Tesla, or are you talking about the inventor, Nikola Tesla? And we look, and unexpected question, and one of the boys goes, the inventor, of course. And she says, really? And what about him? And so I explained, I just replayed the entire conversation for her, just as I did for you, and then said, you know, but, you know, we're arguing over the appropriateness of it because, you know, Edison and Tesla were kind of at odds with each other over, you know, proper currents and other things. Anyway, and the gal is just fascinated. She's obviously intrigued by this, and she goes, really? And is this the sort of conversation, she's talking to the two boys now, she says, is this the sort of conversation you guys just always have? And they both just were taken aback, and they're like, well, yeah, pretty much, this is what we do. And she thought that was so cool. You could just tell. You could see, again, I figured out she must be an alumni of the school. She had gone to this school herself, you know, probably 7-8 years ago. And you could just see that look in her eye going, where were these people when I was in school? Why didn't I have that group? Why? You could see that. I mean, just clear as day. She was just intrigued as all get out. And I wanted to, at that moment, go, well, yeah. If you like that, you'll love this podcast because this is all I do. I sit around and talk nerd crap for an hour and a half because it intrigues the hell out of me. This is and then I could have handed over the card, but of course I didn't have a card, and of course I'm way too self-conscious about that sort of thing to just pop up and go, hey, you should listen to my podcast. But the card would have made it easier. I really should have some of those printed up. I need that. You think? Enough about me, though. Let's talk about me instead. It turns out I haven't been watching much television lately, but I've been thinking about television. So let's do a segment about that.
Kids today, so desensitized by movies and television.
Look, I don't care what the telly says, all right? We have to get out of here.
This is one time where television really fails to capture the true excitement.
You believe everything you hear on TV?
That's right, that jumble of voices means it's time for As Seen on TV, where I just talk about television in general. This is the stuff that's interesting to me. All right, first off, I told you that my son made it to state speech, and I can't say that often enough because I'm so amazingly proud of him. And it turns out that they took actually a team of 11 or 12 kids from their school. They are just amazing. This is the best crop of kids I've seen in a long time. Well, a long time. I've been following speech for 4 years. But they were just spectacular. And sadly, nobody made it to finals at state this year. And so that was a little disappointing. But they made it to state. I mean, we had a team, not just a couple of kids. We had a team go to state. We're so proud. It was just a great, great time. And I'm assuming that it's because of Nana's appendicitis. And that's why everyone was just distracted, and that's why they didn't win, obviously. But besides all that, he made it to speech, and while I didn't get to go to state because of my mom, I did get to go to districts. And while I was there, I watched one of the most amazing duets I've ever seen at a speech competition. And now, you're wondering what this has to do with television. I promise you, I'm getting there. This duet was about two old men escaping from a nursing home. Apparently, these two old men wake up, and it is pancake day at the IHOP, and they're not allowed to leave, and so the two of them plan this huge Mission Impossible James Bond-style breakout where they bust out of the nursing home and get themselves to the IHOP for their pancake breakfast. And it's hysterical. Absolutely hysterical. These guys were very physical, very slapstick, very... I mean, they were on their marks. They were really on top of this. It was a great performance. And in fact, it's one of those that, you know, there's a lot of times that, you know, because my son, with his duet, they took first place at districts? I think so. Anyway, their duet was spectacular. We loved watching their duet. And as, no, they didn't take first. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. That's not the point. With their duet, it's one of those that you know, you see some of them and some people beat them and you're like, God, how in the heck did they not place higher than those guys? But as we watched the old men and the nursing home bit, my son and his partner lean over to me and they go, yeah, if these guys beat us, they deserve it. They are good. And they really were. Because it was the kind of thing where, you know, normally you go to a speech competition, and I don't know how many you've been to, but I've been to quite a lot, and you're always pressed for time. You've got for some of the performances, there's a 10-minute time limit or a 12-minute time limit, and so there's a lot that you have to work into that. And here's these guys playing two old men, so everything they do has to be slow and creaky, and they have to take their time. And so they do a lot of work with facial expression and a lot of work with these little interactions as their bodily movements can't quite keep up with the pace of their thinking. And it's just... It was hysterical. These guys were really good at it. And so as I'm sharing this with Yancey later, I don't know how we got completely sidetracked with this thing. But we finally said, you know what would be a good television show? And I think ultimately, I can't even remember how it all worked out. But we decided that we wanted a television show, which I have tentatively titled Harvey Manor. But an hour-long show about people in a nursing home. And it's going to be a comedy. All right. It's going to be a comedy, but not a sitcom, but definitely a funny show. And here's the magic to it. And here's what makes it different from anything else on television right now. You do Harvey Manor as a two-part TV show. All right. First half of the show. So it's two half-hour comedies back to back, but they're interrelated because the first half of the show is all about the staff members. It's a Scrubs-like environment, and it doesn't have to be like Scrubs. While Scrubs entertains me quite a lot. It kind of got old after a bit, and there's parts of it that are grating. But a Scrubs-style workplace comedy where it is a bunch of people, mostly young people, working in a nursing home, and the residents, the patients in the nursing home, residents, I think is the proper term for them nowadays, are really just background. I mean, yes, we have some interactions with them, and yes, they're there for comic relief, but for the most part, they're set pieces. The old people are just furniture, really, because this is about the lives and the drama of the young people. All right, and that's a half hour. Again, like Scrubs. Now, then you go to commercial break at the middle, and then you come back for the second half of Harvey Manor, and now we do an entire half-hour show about the people, the residents, the old people themselves in the nursing home. And the story is not the same story, because we have a focus on the staff in this story, we have a focus on the old people in this story, and each one has their own concerns and their own dramas and their own high points. But they are stories that take place on the same day or around the same time period. So you will see elements of one show in the other one. So you see a scene that was in the staff version of the show in the first half. You see a scene that happens there. The exact same scene occurs in the second half of the show, but now you're seeing it from the residents' point of view, and you're seeing, oh, yeah, here, it was just comic relief to the staff. It was just, you know, old man Harvey being bizarre old man Harvey, like he always is. But when you watch it again, you realize that, oh, you know what? He's in the middle of his own personal drama, and it's all stuff that is actually really very serious and very important to him, and it makes more sense to see, oh, that's why he did that. And that juxtaposition, and you don't have to always do it staff first and then old people second. You can switch up the two halves of the show because they're meant to be a single unit. I just thought this would be a fascinating way to write a show. And as Yancey says, you would have to then have, you know, you have to have some kind of continuity director, someone who is in charge of the whole project and make sure that everything lines up. And you have to have, you know, joint conferences to make sure everything's going right and that they interlock the way they're supposed to be. But they don't have to be exactly the same because the scene as seen by staff can be completely different. You just have to have the same basic elements, but the exact nature of the dialogue, the exact words, the exact stuff being said and done can vary dramatically from the two points of view and would make it all the more interesting for that. And I just think, what a great idea. If I was the kind of guy who was willing to write up a treatment for this and move myself to Hollywood and try and sell it as a big writer, and then, you know, once I've made my money, then try and retain creative control and hope that Hollywood didn't completely screw up the entire thing for me, because they would. You know, this is something I might pursue. Although, I don't really have the time, and I'm going to put my energies into a creative outlet. It's not going to be television. It's certainly not going to be some pipe dream of writing for a TV show. But if any big Hollywood types are listening to this, or you build even people with aspirations of going to Hollywood with this idea, just give me credit for it. That's all. Steal my idea and give me credit for it, because I think this show would be brilliant. I think it would be a ton of fun to watch. I think this would be a great idea. So there you go. That's my As Seen on TV. I might even start a thread for it. We'll see if you guys want to pitch in some of your ideas, because like I say, once we had the base idea written down, let me back up. I sidetracked myself. You have your story coordinator, your continuity coordinator between the two shows. You have your joint meetings. But essentially, you have, you know, a whole separate writing staff for each show. You have a whole separate crew so that your cinematography is different. Your style is different. They should be very different shows that still operate as a single unit. Again, fascinating. So, if you guys have some great ideas, once we had the bare bones of it worked out, everyone we talked with about the idea of Harvey Manor, the ideas just write themselves, at least for the first few episodes. You can go on forever, and there's no end to good ideas, or at least there's probably 3 or 4 seasons worth of good ideas out of this thing. I mean, Lord knows, you know, with the regular characters you have in this show, I would love to see, like, imagine like 30 Rock, where they have regular guest stars. So they have, you know, you watch 30 Rock and Matt Damon is on for like 6 or 7 episodes in a row. Selma Hayek is on for, you know, a half dozen episodes in a row. They get famous people coming into this little sitcom, 30-minute comedy, and playing real characters and devoting themselves to this thing for, you know, a few episodes, and then they disappear. They do their story arc, and then they're out. Harvey Manor, especially on the resident side of it, is primed for that. Yancey really wants Alan Alda to be a regular guest on this one. But it would be so nice because you can bring in any old star, and there are lots of old stars who, assuming this was a quality show, there's lots of old stars who would love to come in and give their you know, 4, 5, 6 episodes, you know, even just 1 or 2, and then any big star who, okay, they've done their bit and now you want them out, well, kill them off. Because you know what? People in nursing homes die all the time. I mean, it's really easy to write someone out. It's a big enough home that maybe they're in another wing and you just don't see them. But if you really need to, you know, just write them off the show. That was simple. Anyway, I could ramble on about Harvey Manor forever because I really am so enamored of this idea. I really am. And I feel it's a shame that it's not the kind of concept that's in my wheelhouse. It's not the kind of thing that I could actually run with. But I really dig it. So there you go. Enjoy my thought process. But enough of my happy thoughts. You need to get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back. And I just looked at him and went, "Rrr!"
That's right. It's time for some nerd rage. All right. This is my rage. I have been listening to way too much talk radio lately. My iPod has been on the fritz. It required me to restore, and so now I've restored it. And then it doesn't want to load everything, so I've updated the software, and then it doesn't want to load this other stuff, and then I don't know what's wrong. But now I have my new Kindle Fire for my birthday. I may just move all my stuff to the cloud and just use my Kindle Fire. We'll see. But I love my iPod. Anyway, so while I'm working that out, I don't have my iPod. I don't have my podcasts and my music and my stuff to listen to in my car, so I've been listening to a lot of talk radio, which I know is a mistake. You don't have to tell me, but sadly, you know, NPR is only, and when I say NPR, I mean the real NPR, National Public Radio. NPR is only giving me quality news and talk programming, you know, mornings, evenings, weekends. And sadly, during the course of the long work day, there's nothing but classical music, and I can't tune into that. So I go to the AM band, I listen to some talk radio, and here's what I want to give you. And it's not just talk radio that is responsible for this, although, you know, you listen to Rush Limbaugh, you listen to Glenn Beck, you listen to any of these guys, you'll get a heavy, heavy dose of this partisan, hateful bickering. But they're not the only ones guilty of it, all right? I can talk to virtually anyone, and you get them on the subject of politics, which is a bad idea, but you get them on the subject of politics, and it doesn't matter if they're liberal or they're conservative or whatever, everyone is convinced that the people on the opposite side of them, not all of them, not all of them, but the people on the opposite side of them, especially the leaders of their opposition, are evil. That seems to be the general consensus, is that the people who don't agree with me are evil people who are honestly, if not out to ruin America or out to destroy our American way, or, you know, Obama is trying to convert us to socialism, or, you know, the evil Republicans are only doing this because they hate women and they hate minorities and they want to, it's sad. All right. Even if you don't subscribe to, okay, they're evil, well, maybe not evil, but they are all motivated by greed and personal power. That honestly, the only reason that my opposition is even in politics in the first place is to line their own pockets or to, all right, stop. Please stop with all of that. And I know my voice is a small one, and this isn't going to affect most of you, all right? But I can't get over the fact that people are so convinced that others can be truly evil. And yes, look, I admit, you know, in politics, like in any endeavor, there are people who are motivated by their self-interest, or people whose self-interest sways their rational thinking, that they come up with good logical reasons why this thing that, oh, by the way, happens to be really good for my bank account also happens to be the best thing for the nation as a whole. All right, I understand how people do that. But I think, honestly, the vast majority of people in this world truly want what is best for everyone. All right? And specifically, I think most of the people at a national level in politics honestly really want what's best for this country, what they think is best for this country. George Bush, all right, George W. Bush, while he may not have been the brightest bulb in most people's book, and while he did things that I egregiously disagreed with, I did not care for his ultimate application of his ideas, all right, obviously. Even though, yes, I voted for him. I'm sorry. I apologize now. Okay? We're good. But George W. Bush, I honestly think, was a man of principle and a man who truly thought he was a white knight saving us from world terrorism. I think he thought that everything he did was really what was best for this nation. And yes, there may have been some self-aggrandizing stuff in there, stuff that, you know, he wanted to be the white knight. He wanted to be the hero that saved America. I mean, you can, that's pretty tempting. You can't get away from that. But I don't. But ultimately, even if it was for self-important reasons, even if it was for his own power and glory, you got to remember the part of it is he wanted to be the hero that saved America. I mean, saving America is part of that. Making America great again, assuming that we're not great now. That's all part of the plan. I really think he was onto that. And I don't think he was a bad person. I just think he had a lot of bad ideas. I don't question his motives. I think his way of going about things was not right. That's all. All right. Similarly, you know, you could talk about Barack Obama being part of the Chicago political machine, and that, you know, people have tried to claim that he hates America, or that he came out of this political machine, or that he, for whatever reason, he clearly hates America. He wants to apologize for America. He wants to bring us down to the level of other countries. He wants to socialize our nation. He wants to, or God, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, which sadly, again, I have been a lot lately, they want to weaken America and weaken American businesses and corporations because that gives the government more power and specifically gives Democrats more power. You really believe that that's the goal of the President of the United States? You honestly think that that's the man could be shooting for? I have no doubt that Barack Obama truly believes in this country, believes in its greatness, and truly wants to do the things that are best going to help the people of this country. And even for that matter, and it pains me to say it, but Rick Santorum, while he may be a right-wing nut job, Rick Santorum, the more I hear him talk, the more I believe that he believes what he says. I think he is a man of principle. I think Rick Santorum truly believes in his conservative American values, that he believes in this stuff that to me sounds so nutty, and I get that, you know, people want to accuse him of being a racist or a misogynist or a who knows what. But I think he truly, truly believes in his conservative values, and he truly thinks that if he could become president and he could implement everything he wanted to do, he truly thinks he could bring America to a new level of greatness. You know, this unprecedented era of prosperity and freedom and wealth that we've so been longing for. He really believes that. All right, this is not about lining his pockets. This is not about, I mean, would I vote for Rick Santorum? No. Would I be experiencing a sinking feeling of dread if he were to actually win the presidency of the United States of America? Oh yeah, I would. But that doesn't mean I think he's an evil guy. It doesn't mean I think he's a bad person. I just strongly disagree with the ideas that he wants to implement. And I don't want this to be a political show. All right, this is probably the most politics you will ever hear me discuss. Yes, I've clearly thrown in some of my own opinions. You can get an idea of which way I lean and all of that. That's not the important part. All right, it's not a political show. I am not going to discuss politics on a regular basis. You guys can throw out all the comments you want. We can certainly have lots of discussions about it on the boards. This podcast isn't the forum for that. But what I do want to say is, this podcast is a forum for asking for a little bit of understanding and rationality when it comes to discussion. I am about rational ideas. I'm about rational, peaceful understanding in debate and discussion. That is what I like. I like seeing ideas truly analyzed and discussed and dissected without resorting to name-calling and without resorting to stereotypes. And it's a tough thing to find in this day and age. And it's the reason why for the most part, I've withdrawn myself from the political process. I follow politics. I still listen to the news. I still listen to some talk radio. I still do my research on the web. I still vote in every election because that's the kind of person I am. But I don't engage as much in internet debate or any debate on politics because for the most part, it doesn't really go anywhere. It always, well, not always. I found some people on the internet that I like discussing politics with, or religion, or any of these other topics that may be controversial. There are some people on the internet, and in fact, and a lot of them come to my website, and I love them. And there are a lot of people that I can have these discussions with because we all know each other and we all get the gist of being reasonable and listening to the other side, not jumping to conclusions, not throwing out baseless rhetoric or stuff like that. But, you know, that's an exception. There are a few bright spots out there on the internet. There's a few bright spots in the world where you can have an enlightened discussion on these topics. But for the most part, no. New. You can't bring up politics at the workplace. You can't bring up politics on the internet in some comment forum. You can't. And I wish you could. So I wish there was more peaceful, rational discussion out there. That's my nerd rage. It just upsets me that I can't see ideas being discussed. And so when I watch any news show anymore, news shows for the most part, are so full of opinion. And there are some exceptions, all right? I like listening to BBC News. I like listening to NPR News. I can watch some TV news, but for the most part, any news program that is supported by advertising dollars has to have some sort of agenda. I mean, because they have to bring in viewers. You have to present your news in such a way that is going to get viewers, because otherwise advertisers aren't going to give you their money. And once you start sensationalizing the news, once you start running your news for profit, it introduces a bias towards loud argument. It introduces a bias towards extremism. And there's no, and it can be left, it can be right, it can be good, it can be bad. It doesn't matter. It gets you away from truth, and it's sad. And so therefore, you know, BBC, NPR, the two examples I mentioned, these are news sources that for the most part don't have that profit motive. They don't have the corporate sponsorship in the same way that, you know, Fox News or MSNBC or any of those others do. But again, I've rambled on. I wish I could see some more rationality in the world. That's all. And thus ends the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. You know what you want now? I know what you want now. You want a badass movie quote of the week. This one really doesn't need much of an introduction because the names of the characters are right here in the quote. So I'm going to start off with Frodo. Frodo says, "I can't do this, Sam." Sam responds, "I know, it's all wrong. By rights, we shouldn't even be here, but we are. It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo, the ones that really mattered, full of darkness and danger they were, and sometimes you don't want to know the end because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come. When the sun shines, it'll shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you, that meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. But I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folk in those stories had lots of chances of turning back. Only they didn't. They kept going. Because they were holding on to something." And then Frodo replies, "What are we holding on to, Sam?" And Sam ends with, "That there's some good in this world, Mr. Frodo, and it's worth fighting for." That quote about makes me cry every time. I love that speech. I love Samwise Gamgee. I love Sam. I don't even remember what podcast I was just listening to this a month ago. It was either Fear the Boot or it was FilmSack. Could have been either of those. But they were talking about Lord of the Rings, and they were talking about how Lord of the Rings was, at its heart, a story about Sam. That Sam was the true hero of the Lord of the Rings because he's the one that makes the decisions to do right. He's the one who is ultimately always good. And I've said this on the podcast before, but Sam is an ultimate good. He is a simple man. He is not the brightest, but he has a wisdom and a moral center and a goodness that is undeniable. And as they pointed out in this podcast, at the end of the story, who's the one that gets to go back to a happy life? Who's the one that gets the girl? Sam. Sam does. That's why. All right? Sam's our hero. And you got to love Sam. And I love this quote for exactly all of those reasons. This is a highlight. This is a meta comment of Sam talking about the entire story. He's talking about all of the Lord of the Rings, and he's letting us, the reader, know in that moment, or the viewer if you're watching the movie, he's letting us know that yeah, look, we know it's dark. We know you want to give up, but, you know, just like the end of It's a Wonderful Life, you know, this is where it's going to get good. This is where we're going to have the turning point. This is where you're going to see that really good will triumph over evil. It really will work out. I love that. I love Sam. One of my favorite quotes of all time. Which brings us to the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? You send your questions or topics to me by email or, better yet, in a private message on our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list, and Pod-O-Matic becomes whatever you want it to be. Our first number here, R2, is 32. 32 comes from Mr. Serious Paul, who says, have you been watching Sons of Anarchy? Well, yeah, I have. And here's the thing. I'm fascinated by Sons of Anarchy. I think this is a great story. I saw the discussions between you and Jeff and probably some others online, and that was one of the things that prompted me. My wife had been saying for a while that, you know, we should really watch Sons of Anarchy. We should try it out. And I kind of ho-hummed. And then I saw that a bunch of people on the website really liked it, and I'm like, all right, we should give it a chance. And so I saw your discussions. I saw that it's got the undertones of Hamlet, or not even undertones, that it's drawing obviously from Hamlet. And we have watched, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 episodes, something like that. Maybe even more than that. And it's one of those that my wife has sort of faded out on it, that the characters are not extremely likable is part of the problem. I mean, even our hero is, violent and mean. And while he's got his tender side, you know, he's the one good guy in all of this. And I assume the doctor girl who's clearly going to be a love interest again, or at least looks like it. She's our Ophelia, I'm guessing. We've got a couple of good people, but everyone else, their moral center is way the hell off. I mean, there aren't any good guys in this, and that makes it hard for her to watch, I think. I'm enjoying it, but we've kind of trailed off. I mean, you know, we get to TV time at night once all the kids are in bed, and we've got maybe 45 minutes or an hour that we can watch something before we go to sleep. And Sons of Anarchy just hasn't been at the top of the list lately, which is a shame. So I may wind up, if I've got free time, I may wind up watching it by myself, or she may come around and we may decide, let's at least finish out the first season, see how we want to go about it. I'm not sure. But I like Sons of Anarchy. I like it a lot. I think Katie Sagal is brilliant. Brilliant as the queen bitch in this thing. She is awesome. All right. And of course, Ron Perlman is never bad in anything. So it's a good show. It is worth its while. I've taken a break from it, but I'll get back to it. Number 16, also from Sirius Paul. Gnomes have always been portrayed as tinkerers. But what if they were secretly killers? That is a great question. I did not see it going in that direction. All right, what if gnomes were secretly killers? Well, it depends on in what sense. I mean, are we talking like dark evil creatures, and we just don't know that they're evil because we don't know that they're killers? I mean, you do use the word secretly. So what if gnomes were secretly killing for the greater good? Oh, wouldn't that be cool? Gnomes, oh, you know what? I've got my concept. In whatever D&D world we've just created, gnomes are tinkerers, all right? And they always are tinkerers. That's what they do. And at some level, they have their Illuminati-style secret society that has decided to, or Second Foundation secret society, if you want to go Asimovian, where they are tinkering with the fabric of society, that they are creating what they believe is a better world. And in doing so, they're making adjustments to stuff. They tinker a little here, tinker a little there. And the tinkering generally involves removing undesirable elements. Well, look, we got a bad cog here. Let's just take that one out. See? It all works. And they do it secretly. They do it. Everything looks like an accident. All right. A master gnome assassin is a dangerous thing because they are so unassuming. They're gnomes. No one takes a gnome seriously, right? I mean, they're your court jesters. They're your bards. They're tinkerers. And no one's going to suspect that he's secretly a 13th level assassin. That's awesome. I would love to put that into world. In fact, I think I may do that now. Number 95. This one's from Rave Master. Good on you, Rave. As a sometimes technical nerd, I find grammar and word usage to sometimes be important. Because of this, I tend to use larger, more accurate words to better describe an idea or concept, but I just end up confusing people more. Do you ever have this problem? Not as much as I used to. It's actually, Rave, I know you're younger than I am by a good bit, and I will just tell you, it comes with experience. That's really all there is to it. I have an expansive vocabulary, maybe you've noticed, as do all of my children, right down to the six-year-old. My brother's kids are the same way, that they use extremely big words all the time because that's what they hear all the time, and they know that when you come to this situation, that is the best word to describe exactly what's going on. I understand your dilemma. I understand where you're coming from. I understand why you do that, because the right word for the right situation. Now, I would not say I'm so much of a Nazi about it. I am very in love with the English language. I think the English language is amazing. And the comparison I always create is, I highlight, is French. The French language is tightly controlled, all right, at least in France and people who subscribe to the French version of French. And they actually have a government committee that rules on what is and is not appropriate French. They keep their language tightly structured, tightly controlled with the proper pronunciations and proper spellings and the proper word usages, and they seriously hate having foreign words come into French, all right? So when something new comes up, such as email, no. We can't have French people saying email because that is clearly an English-derived word. It was clearly created by the English. Certainly not going to fit in with French. It doesn't even sound French. There's nothing to make that work. So the French went out, and their language committee came out with the best appropriate French substitute, and it's some, multi-syllabic thing that is really awkward to say, especially when 90% of the country is already saying email. And you've come to the game late and said, sorry, email is not appropriate French. If you want proper French, you need to say whatever it is. And I'm not going to be bothered to go look it up. But they come up with the proper French word for email so that we're not borrowing from other languages. All right. And so how many words are there in the French language? I ask you rhetorically because you can't respond anyway, and I already know the answer. There are 50,000 words in the French language, roughly. 50,000. Does that sound like a lot to you? 50,000 is probably larger than my own vocabulary, probably larger than most people's vocabulary. So it's a lot of words. But do you know how many words there are in English? A million. Roughly a million. Do you know why? Because we don't care. We will take anything and we don't care. And I think that's awesome. I think it's gorgeous. We'll borrow words from anybody, anywhere, anything. We will modify words. We'll glom them together, we'll break them apart, we'll shorten them, we'll invent our own. We don't care. And thus, English is ridiculously difficult to learn for a lot of people. We don't follow set rules for spelling. We don't follow set rules for usage. We don't, nothing. Do you know what makes it into the dictionary? We define English in the dictionary. It's defined by how people use the word. So if we change the meaning of the word and we're using it differently in common usage, then, okay, the dictionary will reflect that and they'll put it into the dictionary and say, okay, well, this is now a proper word because, well, that's what people are using. It's an evolving language and it's gorgeous. It is amazing. I love
to say, you know, the word ain't. When I was growing up, they always slapped your wrist for it because ain't is just not proper grammar. It's a contraction that doesn't even have proper words that's derived from, although it's close to am not. Amped was actually the original contraction, A-M apostrophe T, amped. Oh, I should have done this as a word of the week. Why wasn't I? Oh, man, if only you'd asked me this question sooner. But ain't, not a proper word. We all knew it wasn't a proper word, and yet it's in the dictionary. You know why? Because everyone uses it. And again, I certainly wouldn't use ain't in formal writing. But in my informal writing, which is most of what I do, writing on the internet or writing stories or writing stuff for my personal use, I like having a solid written voice, and I love having ain't in there if I need it. It's not one that I'm really enamored of, but ain't could go into something. Gonna, G-O-N-N-A, gonna. Oh, I love the word gonna because it gives you a very casual spoken feel and makes it a lot easier to communicate sometimes. As long as you're getting your meaning across, who cares? You know. So, in your case, to get back to your original question, Rave, you are using words that you feel is the most appropriate word for the situation. It is more exacting than any other word there, and therefore it gets across your ideas the best. Except that, well, if the people you're speaking to don't understand the word, then you've lost the meaning, and you've completely defeated your own purpose. And so therefore, yeah, it's just a matter of experience. I have done the exact same thing. I still do it on occasion. For example, the word tangentially really does not help in casual conversation whatsoever. It doesn't help in a business meeting. I've used the word tangentially twice in conversations with people who were business associates or coworkers or whatever. And both times I got these bizarre quizzical looks that I realized, okay, I just completely lost them with the word tangentially. It threw them off. They don't understand anymore because all they're thinking about is tangentially, even if they know what it means. All they can think is, wow, you're really going to use that in conversation? And so it completely defeated my point. So you're going to have to, you'll learn, you'll get the experience, you'll figure out which words work and which ones don't. And it's all dependent on context and audience. And you'll get there. And I'm not perfect at it, but, you know, the language I use here with you guys on the podcast is way different than the stuff I use when I'm doing computer support at my day job. Because I know you guys are smart. I know everyone who listens to this podcast is a nerd and is a step above, and will follow a lot of these concepts. I don't have to explain most role-playing concepts to you people. I don't have to explain a lot of the comic book references. I don't have to explain any of that, because I know you know it. And I know you'll get the wording and the lingo that goes with that. Whereas when I'm working with people at my job, and I'm doing computer support, I know I got to break it down pretty simple sometimes, because these are people who not only aren't very good at their computers, they actively dislike them because they find it a source of frustration, and therefore they're not going to get even the most simple concepts sometimes. And so I have to, I always start simple, and I start very simple, and I break it down, and sometimes I even apologize for, okay, you know, forgive me if you already know this, but here's where you would start. And then they'll give you the feedback, and they'll let you know, and then suddenly you pick up after a minute and a half of conversation, you realize that, oh, you know what you're doing on a computer. Okay, cool, let's step up the language, let's step up the concepts. I can skip over the long breakdown of how to copy and paste. You clearly know how to do that. Okay, good. Stuff like that. So I sympathize with you. I can only tell you it's going to get better. It honestly will. And you won't even realize it's getting better. It just will. And then one day you'll go, hey, you know what? I don't have that problem anymore. Cool. Or at least not as often. Number 93. I don't even have to scroll up. All right, 93 is from Talvin. And Talvin says, what is your second most embarrassing story about Brasky as a kid? Brasky being my brother. You don't want to know about the most embarrassing story about Brasky? All right, I won't tell it then. You guys missed out. And in fact, I'll put a moratorium on that one. I'm saying, look, I will never tell the first most embarrassing story about Brasky, because he probably wouldn't appreciate it anyway. And you guys will just have to wonder. You guys can make up your own story, all right? You come up with something. And you know what? It's worse than that. All right, but the second most embarrassing story, and then this depends. Do you mean embarrassing to Brasky, or do you mean embarrassing to me? Because we've got lots of stupid stuff we did as a kid. And if you ever listened to the Animal Cast before this one, you got to hear lots of them. And I'm probably going to repeat one of those right now. I have no idea which ones we told and which ones we didn't. But I will tell you, for me, when we were kids, all right, so we're talking, you know, young, one of the most embarrassing things that ever happened to me while I was with my brother was when we were playing, I don't even know what you would call the game, but the game was you close your eyes, and then the other guy will tell you where to go and what to do, all right? So, and this is, in fact, God, I just watched a Mythbusters the other day where they were talking about blind driving, and they had a blind guy behind the wheel, and then Jamie sat in the back seat and gave the blind guy instructions on where to drive, how to, you know, where to go, and the blind guy could drive perfectly well with Jamie as his guide. And then they got Jamie drunk to see if that affected things. And sure enough, with the drunk guide in the back, the blind guy up front drove as if he was a drunk driver, because that's how the instructions were coming. It was awesome. And I played a similar game to that with my cousin Rob. Rob Logic and I, we had, my family had, when we were, I don't know, 13 years old, he's the same age I am, had a tandem bike, a bicycle built for two. And the two of us would ride on that, and the dude up front has to close his eyes, and the dude in back just tells him where to turn. And that's it. This is probably the most dangerous thing you could, well, not the most dangerous, we did lots of more dangerous things, but it's pretty darn dangerous, all right? But it worked out great, and very rarely did we run into stuff, and it was hysterical. We had a great time playing that game. And I, here's the thing that amazes me. If I played that game now, I would be peeking constantly. I would, every 30 seconds, every 60 seconds, I would be, you know, just flashing my eyes open for just for a minute, just to make sure I'm not going to die. Because that's what you would do. And, you know, the guy in back giving you instructions, well, he's looking at your back. He can't tell if you're opening your eyes or not. How's he going to know if you're cheating? And yet, we didn't cheat. That's weird. That's weird and dangerous. That's what teenagers do, at least teenage boys, because they're stupid. All right. So before that, though, my brother and I were playing this game, and it was just blind man's bluff with two people. And so he closes his eyes, and we're out in the middle of the parade field on the military base. And you know, I lead him around, and then I close my eyes, and he leads me around. And he was positive that I was cheating. All right, he was positive I was peeking. And so he was going to test me to prove that I was cheating. And so he went and he led me over to the baseball diamond. And he stood on one side of the chain link backstop while I was on the other side. And then he said, okay, now this way. Come on over here. And so I went after him. And I know we're on a parade field. I know there's very few obstacles out here. And my brother's calling to me, so obviously there's clear space in between us. So I can hear him perfectly. So I actually pick up and start running. And yeah, you can see this coming. And here now, the best part of this story, sadly, is watching my brother tell this story. Because he does an impression of me that makes me look like a complete Australian moron, all right? It, with me flailing my arms happily in the air with the big stupid grin on my face just seconds before I run smack into a chain link fence. And I mean, I hit it hard with my face. Oh, it was horrible. And now, well, maybe that's not the most embarrassing or second most embarrassing, but oh, it was horrible. And it's horrible because he has retold that story hundreds of times since then, because there's always a new audience for, hey, Mike's an idiot kind of stories, right? So that was pretty embarrassing and also painful. We did lots and lots of stupid stuff, but that was a good one. Number 69. This one comes from Sirius Paul yet again. Sirius Paul asks a question. Do you think Bob Hoskins will make an appearance in The Expendables 3? How can I even think that far ahead? I don't know. I don't have an opinion one way or another on Bob Hoskins. I really, I know some people love him. I just don't know that much about him other than Roger Rabbit, right? I mean, is that sad of me? Okay. But here's what I will say about The Expendables. I loved the first Expendables movie. I thought it was great. And I get that it's a bad movie. I know every bit of it that's a bad movie. I get that. Don't care. Love the movie because it did exactly what it promised it would do. It gave us a bunch of our favorite old action stars who are now sometimes jokes, sometimes not, but put them all together in one movie and then did all sorts of outrageous and stupid stuff with them with a plot that meant nothing, just as an excuse for these guys to get together and shoot a bunch of guns And it was glorious. And it was a ton of fun. And I loved watching it. I watched it with my two oldest boys. We had a great time. I would watch it again in a heartbeat. And when Expendables 2 comes out, I cannot wait. You know why? Because Expendables 2 has Jean-Claude Van Damme, who should have been in the first movie. JCVD needed to be in that first movie. And so now they're going to make up for it and put him in this one. Here's the drawback. I mean, yes, we got JCVD. Thankfully, no Steven Seagal. Oh, praise Jeebus. You know, we'll get our Stallone, we'll get our Schwarzenegger, we'll get our Willis, Dolph Lundgren. Dolph Lundgren was one of the best parts of that first movie, all right? We're getting all these guys coming back, Jet Li, and with the addition of JCVD, they've got it perfect, absolutely perfect. And then what happens? Chuck Norris is going to be in this movie. Did you know that? I hope they come up with a decent role for him. I hope that it doesn't become, it's just sad to say about an Expendables movie, man, I hope that doesn't make it stupid. I get how ironic that is for me to say that. But here's the deal. I didn't know Chuck Norris was going to be in this film until my son just told me the other day. And he says, now this is all just rumor. I have not done any research. I haven't verified this in any way. All I know is Chuck Norris will be in it. That part of his statement is true. But his next statement is that, oh yeah, one of the conditions of Chuck Norris being in this movie is that he wanted a PG rating or a PG-13. That, okay, so they're going to have to tone down some of it to make it Chuck Norris acceptable, to make it Chuck Norris appropriate? Really? I mean, look, I get that his religion is very important to him, and I get that he is projecting a very different image from these other Expendable stars, and certainly a different image from the first Expendables movie. And if he wants to stick with projects that are PG, again, I'm hoping this is just a rumor. I'm hoping it's not true, because I don't see it having the same impact as a PG movie. I mean, Expendables was rated R for a reason. It was rated R, wasn't it? Man, my whole point here would be completely stupid if that was not a rated R movie. I should go look that up. Hold on. Yeah, okay, I'm not crazy. It was rated R. Of course. I mean, with that level of violence, that level of language, blood, it was... Oh, and it was great. And I'm just afraid that a PG version of The Expendables is just not... It's going to be watered down. And again, as much as it's already a stupid movie, I understand that maybe I'm just nitpicking at something that doesn't need to be picked at, but I would hate to see that. So I'm hoping that that's not true. I'm hoping that Chuck Norris doesn't ruin this film by making it more kid-friendly. That would be terrible. Terrible. And Chuck Norris is not essential to it. I mean, I get Chuck Norris is a big name, and Chuck Norris is Chuck Norris, and we all know our Chuck Norris jokes, and we love our Chuck Norris jokes because they're awesome. But I would hate to see them including him just for that name recognition factor and making concessions that ruin the rest of the film. Let's hope that doesn't happen. If anyone's got any information on it, let me know. Number 86. Hey, this one's from Akiva. Is this my first from Akiva, or is this my second? I can't remember if we had one from him last week. All right, anyway. Akiva says, would you sell your soul to the devil to be the greatest DM in the world? Because I would. All right. No. One, because I don't have to. I am already the greatest DM in the world, and I certainly hope the devil doesn't offer you that proposition, because I would hate to lose my top spot. All right. But secondly, if I could actually sell my soul to the devil, if he was actually here making offers, that would actually then imply that, yes, all of that is true, and that my soul actually matters and is an existing proposition beyond this life, and therefore, if the devil were there to actually offer it and could actually give me the magic to become a better DM, well, do I want to trade a marginal improvement on my abilities for the next 30, 40 years for eternal suffering? I don't think I could do that. I mean, that seems pretty strict. I'd probably have to get a new car out of it, too. I'm not sure. But it seems, I mean, it does seem pretty big, doesn't it? Okay. But would I like to be a better DM? Yeah, I would love to be a better DM. I can make jokes because I love the games that I play. I'm an awesome DM. I'm the best of the game masters that I've worked with, but that's only because I don't ever let anyone else game master. It's pretty easy to be the best that way. But I also do know my weaknesses. There are, I'm good at coming up with some stuff on the fly, but then there's other things that I get locked up because, okay, they went off the charts. I have some stuff prepared. I have some stuff not. We'll wing it a little bit. But but, you know, having the extra boost of creativity in those moments, because sometimes we do great stuff, and then sometimes it's like, okay, you know what? I need to take a 15-minute break. I need to regroup. Let's come back in just a moment, which is what you need to do. You don't want to rush through something in a game and then wind up being stuck with a plot point that you're really not happy with just because you felt like you needed to come up with something on the spot. If you're really not satisfied with it at that moment, you take a break. You say, hey, look, let's all take a break. Go away for a few minutes. I wasn't ready for this. Let me regroup, and we'll come back when I have something good. That's all well and good, but it does then break the momentum of the game. It breaks the momentum of the story. So there's a trade-off there. I also know that I am not as good at voices as I always thought I was. I think I've brought this up, but man, I used to think I was a great actor. I used to think I was a wonderful actor and that I did wonderful voices, and then I did. And then the fact that every time I did a voice, my players would make fun of me for it. I assume that that's just because they were juvenile idiots. Turns out, probably not. It's probably because I'm really not that good at voices. And that's okay. You know what? I understand my weaknesses as a game master. I understand the things that I could do better. And there are things that I work on, and then there's things that I just compensate for. That's fine. But yeah, sure, I'd love to be a better dungeon master. I just wouldn't want to trade off that skill for eternal suffering. That seems excessive, really. Number 94 from Zimny Pot. Oh, I love you, Zim. All right, Zimny asks, do you have any weird body skills? Oh, wouldn't you like to know? Yeah, well, okay, actually, I don't have a whole lot of weird body skills. I really don't. I'm not double-jointed. I don't. I wouldn't have qualified for Letterman's Stupid Human Tricks back when that was on. It's not something I do, but I do have, and this is really, really lame. I admit that it's lame. I get it. I have a trigger finger on the index finger of my right hand. That's the only thing I've got. And when I say trigger finger, what I mean is I can lock my finger and bend only the tip of that index finger. So just the tip. I can bend just that one joint while locking the others. And even that, God, see, I'm doing it right now. And even that, I'm not as good as I used to be. It doesn't lock as well as it used to. And that trigger finger, that little lock there where I can bend just the tip without bending the rest of the finger, that came from years of playing Atari 2600, specifically using the paddle wheel games. I think, if I remember correctly, I think that's what really got me into it. But anyway, the way you hold that and the way you play that game, you play those games with that controller, the Atari 2600 gave me the ability to lock that one joint in the middle so that I could bend just the tip. And see, I can't do it on any of my other fingers, just that one. And even then, it's still kind of lame. It's still, I can't get it to bend as far as it used to. I used to be able to lock it and then bend the whole thing down to 90 degrees. And now not so more. Because I don't, you know, it's not a skill you practice, really, right? So that's it. As if I think of any others, I'll bring them up. But for right now, yeah, I don't have anything. Number 40. Hey, it's Stan. Say hello to Stan, everybody. Hi, Stan. Geekiness, nature or nurture? Both. You know what? I think we all have physical proclivities, mental proclivities that, you know, you're going to be potentially more naturally athletic, based on your genes, or more naturally intelligent, or these things will come from your genetics. And that will have, if you're naturally good at something, you may be more likely to lean towards that. But I also think nurture is a heavy influencer on it, as witnessed by my own children. Now, again, my children also have my nerd genes, so it's really hard to separate the two. We would really, I would have to have another kid and give it away to a family full of jocks and see what happens. You know what? I think I'll do that. I'll talk to my wife, but I think we can manage that one. And then that way we could raise that child, well, have that child raised by a family of jocks, and then see how much of the nerdiness, how much of my inherent genetic nerdiness comes out in that child, and how different they are being raised by a family who's into sports and hunting and athletics and things that I'm not. All right, we'll try that and we'll find out. But I think it's a combination of both. Probably more nurture than nature, but a combination of both. Number 56 comes from Serious Paul. Serious Paul says, what is your favorite John Cusack movie? Oh, all right, that's easy. My favorite John Cusack movie is Better Off Dead, or Being John Malkovich. Either of those. I love those two movies. I think they're spectacular. Better Off Dead has been a favorite of mine since the moment I first saw it. I thought it was brilliant. It is a ski movie that features all of 5 minutes of skiing. That's great. All right. And it is just a funny, funny film. It is really hysterical. I highly recommend it to everybody. And Being John Malkovich is bizarre and a half. I love that film. I own that film. Great, great movie. Now, I love John Malkovich. I love John Cusack in anything and everything. The guy is great. And this is just, again, rumor. I don't know how true it is, but I've heard that John Cusack does one movie for the studios, like America's Sweetheart or 2012, or, you know, one of these big blockbuster style romantic comedy or blockbuster action or whatever. He does, you know, one movie for the studios, and then he gets to do one movie for himself, where you get movies like Being John Malkovich or Identity or these quirky off-the-wall things, 1408, things that are not going to be a huge commercial success, or at least aren't intended to be. And I've heard that that's how he trades off. He gets one film for his own artistic vision and then one film to make everybody some money so they don't mind him going off and doing his own thing. If that's a true story, that is spectacular. I have all the respect in the world for him. And I don't begrudge him any of the blockbuster films. Some of them I've enjoyed. Some of them I haven't. You know, you can say it's compromising his artistic vision or his whatever. But he's doing what he wants to do. And he's making a great living at it. I got to admit, I have seen Gross Point Blank. And didn't enjoy it. I don't know why. I mean, I saw it a long time ago. And I have seen enough stuff lately. I mean, just in the last 2 years, I've seen stuff about Gross Point Blank and people talking about how much they love it. And it makes me think, God, maybe I should go back and rewatch that. But I remember just hating that thing when I first saw it. I mean, it was okay. It was kind of cute. It was kind of funny. But it just didn't connect with me. It didn't resonate with me in any way. And also, truth in advertising, I have never seen High Fidelity all the way through beginning to end. I have seen so much of that movie. I know I have seen 70% of it, and I understand exactly what that movie is about. And I know that if I ever saw the thing beginning to end, I would probably really, really love it. I've just never done it. How is that even possible? How can I not have watched High Fidelity? I have got to correct that, and I know I won't, but I really, really should. I mean, if I want to keep my cred, I really need to. Number 16 from a man called Scree. Scree says, out of all the Marvel characters, which is your favorite? And then there's a follow-up question, which one do you think is the best? All right, well, let's get to the easy question first. My favorite, Nightcrawler. I love Nightcrawler. Nightcrawler is awesome to me. Nightcrawler has this conflicted religion in his background, that he mixes with and covers up for with his swashbuckling personality. Plus, he's blue, and he has a tail, and he looks like a demon, and he can teleport with fire and brimstone and the whole business. Nightcrawler is my favorite Marvel character of all time, my favorite superhero of all time. I love him. One day, I will tell you guys about Rook. Rook is my own personal superhero. When I was playing superhero role-playing games, Rook was a character that I created back for the old Villains and Vigilantes game, and I loved Rook. You know what? I'll tell you about him now. And I loved Rook as a character for that game, and then every superhero game I've played since then, I always recreate Rook in some way, and he's had different names and different variations, but it's the same essential power. And I take a lot of Rook from Nightcrawler. He was clearly my inspiration when I first did this. Rook has the ability to split himself into two copies. He has one that is the real copy and one that is the illusion copy. And the illusion copy is a perfect representation of him, except it's completely insubstantial. It can walk through walls. But it looks like him. It sounds like him. And he sends out his copy of himself. And it can go anywhere, you know, whatever the range is, doesn't make any difference. And he can control that copy, control both versions of himself. He controls the copy, can see through its eyes, hear through its ears. So he's got this dual nature going on. And then at will, he can then switch places with his copy. He can then just teleport to wherever the copy happens to be. All right. And in doing so, because in the original game he had extra powers left over or he needed some sort of offensive capacity. And so I built this into the character and then I've just always kept it, that whenever he makes a switch like that, which, by the way, is called castling, because, see, his name is Rook, and he castles. You get that? Yeah, switch places? All right. So when he castles into his duplicate's position, and then, you know, his old self becomes the duplicate, it builds up some sort of energy charge within his body. And the more he switches back and forth, the more this energy builds up until eventually he has to release it. And so he wears a special suit and special gloves to contain the power, and then he only releases it at will. And, of course, he has to release it before it builds up too far. But then he releases this energy as an electrical blast or whatever, and it's a touch attack. And so he winds up shocking other people, essentially. And I love Rook. I mean, he is based on Nightcrawler because I've always, always adored Nightcrawler. In fact, I think my real love of Nightcrawler came from the old Magic series when we have this four-issue limited series of Magic being trapped in limbo. And this was before I really knew the X-Men as well as I know them now. And Nightcrawler in that was evil. I mean, he had been corrupted by the plane of limbo, and he was an actual demon, and he was very, very evil. But we had some discussion and some talking. You could see the man he used to be, and I just fell in love with Nightcrawler. I love Nightcrawler. Kurt Wagner is awesome. And so, based on that, I built my own very favoriteest role-playing superhero character of all time, Rook. I built him based on those kinds of concepts. There's a lot of similarity between the two, and I totally dig that. All right, now, second part of Scree's question is, which one do you think is the best? Well, it depends on how you define the best, because the way I would define the best, I would say Nightcrawler, because he's so awesome. Are you not paying attention? All right. But when you say best isn't, well, I don't know, the best as in the best as an actual character to carry his own comic book, the best as in can defeat anybody else, the best as in, it's hard to say. Because, you know, I've also got a serious fondness for Captain America, because I love the whole goody-goody nature of him, and I've always liked Captain America as a concept better than I've liked his actual comics, and, you know, maybe that's a testament to trying to figure out the conflict of a goody-goody like that. I don't know. But as far as best, I really can't answer that one without more criteria. I'm going to have to let that one slide. Boom! Number 67. Hey, this one comes from Billy Bob, and Billy Bob says, what's the last podcast you listened to other than your own? Driving to the airport to pick up my mom, I listened to two episodes of Walking the Room. And I've described Walking the Room on the show before and how much I like it and how it is completely inappropriate for most listeners. It is shocking and raunchy and filthy. Be forewarned. But that's what I listened to. And I actually, because my iPod's on the fritz, I actually had my computer in the car with me. Had it, fortunately, still had 4 or 5 hours of battery life left on it. So I actually plugged my iTrip into the headphone port on my computer. And so I left the thing sitting in the back seat and had it broadcasting to the speakers. And so I got to listen to two episodes in a row of Walking the Room on the way to the airport. And they were really funny. And I had a lot of fun listening to them. And you know what? I think that's going to be the end for this day. Let's do a quick recap and then we'll get into the credits.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. This week's theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write us a nice review. Or if you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, you know the very best way to talk to me is to come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up, you send me a message, we'll hang out, we'll have fun. All right, number 35 from Brasky. First off, you guys will notice that I've stopped doing real end bits. I just keep giving you the extra Podomatic entry at the very end of the show. I may go back to things like Diary of a Sidekick, or go back to my anti-captain story, or if there's some new things introduced, or if you people have something and you want to submit it to me and you want me to, you know, either read it or you give me the audio of it or whatever, and if it's good enough, you know, I can throw it in here at the tail end. I like having stuff like that here at the end, but I just, they're really, to get good ones is really time consuming, really labor intensive, and the ones that aren't good, or the that aren't, and it's not, I shouldn't say not good, but some of them just, I feel I've run out of stuff, and I don't want to be lazy, and I don't want to offer you something substandard in this end segment. So if I'm going to give you something, I want it to be quality. And so in the absence of real quality, we'll let R2 pick something for us, and I'll just give you the one extra entry. And like I say, this one's number 35. This one is from Brasky. Brasky says, Robert Heinlein was a misogynist, right? Duh! Oh, I cannot stand when Robert Heinlein is offered as a genius, as a forerunner of modern science fiction, as a, that he's some kind of progressive, that he's, the, yes, he had some spectacular ideas. He is a great science fiction writer and offers up a lot of real awesome stuff in a lot of ways. But let's not forget that ultimately, most of Heinlein's stories are a bunch of adolescent, male, teenage wish fulfillment fantasy things that should really be viewed in exactly, even his most groundbreaking, all right, Stranger in a Strange Land is offered up as his most, I don't even know, most profound book. Stranger in a Strange Land, you know, once Valentine is set up and he's becoming the new messiah of Earth, and it's, he sets up a harem for himself, and he sets up a little harem of, oh, one blonde, one redhead, one brunette. And, oh, all of them super hot, all of them super voluptuous, all of them sexually open and experimental. And it's clearly, and he's phrasing it in this term of sexual liberation and openness and equality. But no, it's one dude with this matching set by hair color of girls who are really interchangeable. He tries to give them their own personalities, but they're really interchangeable, and they're just there as this wish fulfillment thing. And so many of his stories are like that, that... I mean, clearly Lazarus Long, who every story he wrote for how long, how many books, how many series, ultimately tied back into Lazarus Long and the universe. You get this long, huge tale, this huge new science fiction story from Robert Heinlein, and at the very end, the last two chapters involve whoever it is, whoever's been the focus of this book, now suddenly stumbles into Lazarus Long's universe and now becomes part of his world. And Lazarus Long was clearly Heinlein's Mary Sue character. All right, clearly that's what he was creating here. This guy who lives forever and has sex with anybody and everybody. He, at one point, he has a computer character that they get to the point where, you know what, they're going to transfer the computer's mind and personality into the hottest female form they can possibly create just so Lazarus Long can have sex with her. Lazarus Long has twin girl clones made from himself, all right? They clone him. They double up the X chromosome. He winds up with these twin girl clones of himself. And at the age of, I think, in the book, I swear to God, I think at the age of 13 or 14, and Lazarus at this point is, I don't know, 700. But these twin girls are 13 or 14, and they come around with this huge, long justification for why... incest is not wrong if there's no risk of genetic imperfection, and therefore Lazarus has sex with his 13-year-old twin clones. All right, that's misogynist. This is all just they found a way for him to have sex with prepubescent versions of himself. That's just wrong. Okay, no matter how you dress it up, again, it's just adolescent fantasy, and that's all it is. And he does this over and over and over. And, okay, let's look at his female characters. His female characters can be bisexual, or sometimes outright lesbians, but most often bisexual. Happens all the time. His main female characters are generally not. They may often be tempted to be in a bisexual or lesbian relationship, but if it's a main character, he doesn't do that to them. But if it's a supporting character, yeah, they'll bisexual it up all the time because that's part of the male fantasy. His male characters are never gay. His male characters, supporting or otherwise, are never gay, with one exception. One exception, he had an old man character, and not even old man, but the guy speaks, and he's a guy who is heterosexual and lovingly married, and has no problem, but he speaks of, they have one scene where he speaks of a time in his youth, in his adolescence, when he experimented with homosexuality and decided it was gross and not for him, and therefore it never happened again. That is the only gay reference in any of his works. Lesbians, everywhere. Bisexual women, everywhere. Gay dudes, one guy, and only there to prove that, yeah, I'm open-minded. Sure, I tried it, but it was gross. It was really gross. Never did it again. And it never happens again in any of his books, because that's just the way it works. All right? So, Robert Heinlein is a horrible, horrible misogynist. You are absolutely correct. I have always said that, and I will have people argue with me until the sun comes up. There are people who are just horrified that I will not recognize this man's brilliance, and I'm sorry, I can't stomach those people. You've got to, yes, you are allowed to admire a lot of the stuff that Heinlein has done. You are allowed to give him credit for some of the amazing concepts he did, for some of the very engaging and entertaining stories that he wrote, because I've read everything he's done. Job, or the Book of Job, I can't remember what the title of it was, but Job, one of my favorite books by Heinlein, really, really good. An exploration of religion and faith and this, and it was really entertaining. All right, so there's some great things he's done, but most of his stuff all ties back to the same fantasy world and all ties back to he's a sexist, misogynist pig. That's just all there is. All right, you can admire him, but don't deny and don't try and excuse it as, oh, well, he was writing in a different age. This was the 60s and 70s. I don't give a crap. All right? He's not progressive. He's not open-minded. He was a libertarian, almost anarchist in his writings, espousing stuff that is just so simplistic in its theories. And people will offer it up as, see, utopia could be here. We could have a perfect world if we would just frickin' train. Hold on. See, if we could just let go, no laws, no rules, no government interference, just eye for an eye, every man defending his own. We could have a perfect utopia doing that. No, you couldn't. You're so simplistic and so out of touch. He's not. Yes, he is a great writer, and yes, he has done some stuff that you can admire. But please, don't use the fact that you fell in love with this as a 13-year-old to excuse the fact that he's a horrible misogynist. All right. That's enough.